From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the July 2024 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. The Forgotten Army. In early 1942, one of the most disastrous defeats of the war saw British forces pushed out of Burma, now known as Myanmar. 2 years later, the multinational 14th Army, the Forgotten Army, had learned to fight and beat the Japanese, inflicting their largest defeat of the war at Imphal and Kohima, and was poised to begin the reconquest of Burma. This turnaround had much to do with bitter experience gained in close combat and superb logistics, but an important element was detailed intelligence, which allowed the Allies to seize control of the skies and control the battle below. In this It Happened Here episode, Research Officer Dr. Thomas Cheetham leads us through the transformations at Bletchley Park, at Signals Intelligence Centres in Southeast Asia, and on the front lines, which turned defeat into victory.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
The Bletchley Park podcast has been going for nearly 12 years now, and we like to go into detail, and we've covered so many topics, but one of the campaigns that we haven't really covered as much as we should has been the Southeast Asia campaign, and particularly the Burma campaign. And that's what we are going to attempt to cover in this episode. Now, Tom, why Burma and why now?
Burma, because it's important in the war. Strategically, it's important for Bletchley Park as well. There's a really interesting story to tell about signals intelligence in Southeast Asia. And it's a big deal at Bletchley Park. There are hundreds of people here working, supporting this campaign. And I think, as we'll see, some parts of that story at Bletchley Park have been neglected more than others. And so setting the record straight in that way, I think, is worthwhile. And why now? Because it is about 80 years since the closing stages of the battles of Imphal and Kohima, which were really the turning point of the campaign in Burma. And so it seemed as good a time as any to tell the story, at least up to that point. And next year, when we get to the 80th anniversaries of the events of 1945, we will talk about final victory in the various campaigns in East Asia. But what we want to do with this episode is fill in the story from the start of the war with Japan up to the middle of 1944.
All of these campaigns in Southeast Asia are kind of less well known in this country than, you know, the European theatre. But the amount of countries involved on the Allied side is vast, isn't it?
Yeah, the diversity of nations represented on the Allied side is a really notable feature of war in that part of the world. And so as we go along and I say British, what I'm really referring to are British troops, but also Burmese ones, troops from India, and I mean all parts of India, what is then under the Raj, Gurkhas from Nepal, East and West Africans, Chinese troops, and Americans are all serving in this campaign. It is a truly multinational effort, and that is both the weakness and the strength of the British forces in that theatre, I think.
And it is a predominantly British-led operation, isn't it, as opposed to American-led?
Yeah, but there is an important American element as well, and a Chinese element. There are these international discussions in how to fight the war in Burma, and it's not a clear chain of command. It's not just the British who are in control here who can do what they want. There is a political element to it, which is very significant as well. So part of the reason why it's so forgotten, I think, is because it's a complex picture and it's hard to get your head around.
Right, okay.
Especially for people who aren't familiar with that part of the world and people who aren't that familiar with the whole Second World War, Burma is not an easy starting place.
Well, let's find a good starting point then. Why is there a war in Burma in the first place?
Strategically significant for the Japanese. When they attack the US and Britain and the Dutch in Asia in December 1941. The Japanese aim is to establish various buffer zones for their economic zone that they want to create in Southeast Asia and in Australasia. So they, obviously in the Pacific, are trying to capture various islands. They're trying to capture New Guinea to provide a buffer against Australia. And going around to the west, they attack Malaya and eventually capture Singapore. And to protect the flank of that operation and the whole western flank of the Japanese sphere of influence, and also to threaten India, this is why they go into Burma. They also want to capture resources. There is substantial resources of oil in Burma. And the Japanese, one of the reasons why they attack in the first place is because they're short on strategic resources, especially oil. And with their reserves dwindling, their judgment seems to be that it's now or never. Another motivation is that the Japanese have been embroiled in this war in China since 1937, which in many ways is far more significant for them than war against European powers or America. By far, the largest number of Japanese forces are engaged in China throughout the war. And the Chinese are being supplied by the Allies through Burma, at what they know as the Burma Road. So cutting that road and cutting off Western support for China is an important motivation for going into Burma as well.
Can you give us some background of the invasion of Burma then? How does that play out?
So if we picture the geography of Burma, because I wouldn't blame people for not being that familiar with it, the Japanese are going to be attacking from Thailand, which sort of meets the southeastern corner of Burma, if you like. The Japanese have occupied Thailand sort of as an aggressor, sort of being invited in. And that positions them towards what for the British is really the key part of Burma to control, which is the southern coast. You have Rangoon, modern day Yangon. This is the communications hub to the centre of the country. And the geography looks kind of like, if you picture an upside down vase, open at the bottom, you've got mountain ranges around the other three sides of the country. So the only way you can really access the interior of Burma is from the south. And in the middle, you've got this sort of central coastal plains, or at least a number of plains. And you have a number of rivers running north-south through the country. And in the south of the country, you have the rivers Irrawaddy and the Sitang going west to east. And in the north of the country, the Irrawaddy sort of curves around to one side. And then it becomes the Chindwin on the west and the Irrawaddy in the east. And these obviously provide good communication links, and a lot of the population of the country is focused along these rivers and these valleys that they create. And that means north to south movement is quite straightforward, but moving across those mountain ranges that ring the rest of the country is very difficult, and that will be the chief problem for both sides in the campaign, is that geography. But the British have the problem that the Japanese are poised in Thailand to cut straight across. If they capture Rangoon in the south of the country, that basically makes the rest of the country untenable. So the British forces in Burma are pretty poorly prepared. They're forced to deploy close to the Thai border because they can't allow the Japanese to penetrate too far into the country. That's also where they have their air forces. So the British air bases, again, are positioned quite close to the border. But that becomes a disadvantage because then they're vulnerable to Japanese attack. And also, there is insufficient distance for the Allied Air Forces to receive good warning of Japanese air attack. And for diplomatic reasons, the British aren't able to fly over Thailand and carry out good reconnaissance. Generally, the intelligence picture at the beginning of the campaign is pretty poor. So the Japanese are able to launch attacks across the border and hit British forces without them having good warning, and hit British air bases as well, without them really being able to defend themselves. And that kind of exacerbates the fact that the British forces are much smaller. Their air forces are pretty tiny by comparison to the Japanese. So in the beginning of the campaign, there's only two fighter squadrons available. They receive some reinforcement from what's called the American Volunteer Group, who are better known as the Flying Tigers.
Ah, right.
Who have their modern P-40s. They paint these jaws on the front of their aircraft, which are quite iconic. And they perform well, these American Volunteer pilots, but they're not able to tip the balance in the favour of the Allies. About 35 Allied aircraft in total versus about 150 Japanese. So the Japanese have constant air superiority in the early part of the campaign. And as soon as they capture those air bases, they're close to the border again, they can bring their air forces to bear pretty easily.
So what year were you born in?
I was born 1923.
Where were you born?
Rangoon.
In Burma?
Yes.
So you went to school in Rangoon?
Yes, very nice school. The Methodist English Girls High School. It was an American Methodist foundation. Very well run. Of course, English was the main language of the school. We had girls of every nationality. There were no other schools to educate girls. The Burmese Pongi Chongs, as they were called, only educated boys.
Yeah.
So the Burmese girls didn't get a look in. But they did in the mission schools. And very clever, bright girls they were too, I might tell you.
Did you have any brothers and sisters at school with you as well? Or?
Yes, my eldest sister, and I had two brothers and a younger sister. The elder of the two boys was in the RAF, and he was killed in an air exercise in Germany. That was very sad. He was very handsome. He really looked good in his RAF uniform. I stayed, did the full course up to what was called the 10th standard, and then I got a place in Rangoon University.
You were 18 then, were you?
17 and a half.
17 and a half.
I was 18 when once I was in university. I was going to read maths, very hopefully.
So you started university?
And I didn't finish it.
Right.
It all came to an abrupt end with Pearl Harbor. It happened overnight.
Yes.
I was in college. You've never seen anything empty so fast. Pearl Harbor was bombed. Monday morning, the university shut, and parents came from everywhere and removed all their students. And I think they were right to do so, because the Japanese bombed Rangoon for the first time on the 23rd of December. And then on the 25th of December was the second air raid. They flew up and down, machine gunning the streets. There was very little air defence. So my father came down at once, collected my sister and I. The younger ones were in boarding school in the north of Burma. And that's the last time I saw Rangoon.
So you've had to leave university.
Yep.
Your dad came and collected you, your sister.
That's right.
What happened then? Did you have to leave the country?
Eileen, my elder sister, immediately joined up with the hospital and was ultimately brought out safely to India with the hospital. My mother, I said, what do you want me to do? I don't want to be a nurse. She said, will you take the three younger ones to India? The army were taking us all out. The army was so good. They really were good. They looked after everybody. We had one hairy moment. As we were loading up the plane, the DC-3, it came across with troops, and all the troops came out of the plane, and refugees, evacuees, whatever you want to call them, were loaded into the plane. There was the sound of a plane. It was a Japanese plane. We were there in the middle of the airfield with the aircraft. People with their bags, etc. That Japanese plane flew low over us, so low we could see the pilot. We almost could make eye contact with him. He circled slowly round, and we all followed him around with our eyes, not knowing what's going to happen, because they had already attacked a station. He did nothing. He went all the way round, and he tipped his wing, and he flew away.
Good.
And I said a prayer for him that night, because he could have machine-gunned us, he could have destroyed that plane, he could have created carnage, and he did nothing. He just flew away. I've always thought that was a story worth telling. I wonder who he was and what his report was when he flew back to the airfield from which he came.
What we'll see from the start of the campaign is that air power is pretty critical. That will be, again, one of the defining features. You know air power is important in World War II, but even more so than normally in Burma. So it's one of the reasons why it goes pretty badly for the British in the beginning. They have the 17th Indian Division, which kind of meets the initial Japanese attack. And they're defending several rivers as they retreat, but they're unable to properly oppose any of these river crossings. And there is a disaster, really, in the early stages of that campaign at what's called the Battle of the Sitang Bridge. That's one of the major rivers, and the division is defending a bridgehead, but it doesn't have enough troops to stop the Japanese infiltrating and threatening the actual bridge behind them. The commander actually takes the decision to blow up the bridge when most of the division is still on the other side to deny it to the Japanese. Most of the troops get out, but most of them have to actually swim the river. Most of them are pretty much They're without any of their heavy equipment. Many of them lose most of their uniforms. They're pretty much in their underpants. They're destroyed as a fighting force. And at that point, you know, the battle's been lost. The Japanese are able to cut across, capture Rangoon pretty much without a fight. They cut off the bottom of the vase, and the remaining British forces in the interior of the country, they're therefore cut off from their communications. There are routes in through India and China to the north of Burma, but these are not developed in any way. There aren't really modern roads. The only kind of possible supply route is by air, and the British don't have enough planes to support the troops. So by that point, best they can do is sort of delaying tactics. And the Japanese are able to advance north from the coast, following those rivers. Every time they meet British forces, quite quickly they develop a very effective tactic, which is that they will pin that force there. They will send a flanking column round to the side, and they will set up a roadblock on its line of communications behind it, on one of these very few roads that exists. And that forces the British to disengage from the front, to turn around and break through that roadblock and retreat northwards. So the whole campaign is a series of these battles where the British take a position, but they get outflanked and they have to retreat to maintain their line of communications.
And the British are retreating basically back towards India, aren't they?
Yeah, back sort of north and eventually westwards into India. And it carries on like that. They're never able to, eventually they do get reinforcements, they get a number of tanks, and they're able to sort of give the Japanese a bloody nose at certain points, but they're never able to put up enough resistance to stop them, and really the position is untenable. And this continues all the way through the spring of 1942 until the monsoon breaks in about May, June time. And that pretty much brings the campaign to a halt. But by that point, the British are basically on the border of India.
You say the monsoon breaks. The fighting is far more seasonal than, say, in Europe, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's one of these parts of the world where there's a wet season and a dry season. And the wet season runs from about May to November. And it is only really possible to conduct large-scale operations in the dry season. During the monsoon season, the roads tend to deteriorate and it's impossible to move around.
You mentioned that there was no effective reconnaissance earlier. Is there any effective intelligence being gathered?
Well, not really. And this is one of the problems for the British, because they're being outmaneuvered, not because the Japanese are that much more mobile. They send these columns out into the jungle. They're quite slow moving and they take days or weeks to work their way around the British defences. But the British have no way of knowing they're there until they burst out of the jungle and block the roads. So poor intelligence is a really important factor in this kind of early defeat. They haven't got good land or air reconnaissance because they haven't got air superiority. They haven't got the sort of organisation you need on the ground to head out into the jungle and work out where the Japanese are. The ability to capture enemy reports and orders is pretty limited and gather intelligence that way. And the Japanese generally don't surrender. But of course, when you're on the retreat, there's even less opportunity than normal to capture prisoners of war. And actually, in early 1942, in the whole of Burma, they only have one officer who can actually read and speak Japanese.
Right, so even if they've captured them, they're not going to understand.
So they don't have any system for generating intelligence from these, you know, what we would now call human intelligence, human. And even later in the campaign, they're always short on linguists in the field. And it's a criticism you can make of the signals intelligence operations, even though we like to emphasise how important they were. It's a criticism you can make that signals intelligence actually soaks up a lot of the skills base for Japanese linguists. And there isn't enough available in the field to do that sort of on-the-ground intelligence work, which is still vital later on in the campaign. So poor intelligence, inability to exploit the intelligence that they do have is a really important factor in that initial defeat.
A lot of what we're going to cover in this episode happens in 1944. Now, what happens in those 2 years in between? You've just said spring 42. You know, what happens in that 2 years, 18 months in between? It's not all quiet on the South Asian front, is it?
No, it's a process of learning for both sides, but more successfully for the British. What happens when the Japanese have occupied the country is that you have three or four kind of smaller focal points of the campaign from that point on. So if we go from west to east, there's a coastal region called the Arakan in western Burma, which is sort of on the other side of those mountains. So it's quite exposed and open to attack from the British. So it's an ideal place for them to strike back as soon as possible. And they start launching operations in Arakan as soon as the monsoon season ends at the end of 1942. And they're able to come down from what is now modern day Bangladesh and try and capture ground from the Japanese. but with limited success initially. If we go around to the kind of centre of the front, further east, you've got the main Burma-India border, very mountainous terrain, and it's not a scene of decisive action in 1943, but there is a constant back and forth struggle as both sides kind of jostle for territory. And again, they're learning there as well how to meet the Japanese and how to beat them. If we go even further around to the northeast of Burma, we move away from the front controlled by the British and to the area controlled by the Americans and the Chinese. There is a combined Chinese-American command called Northern Combat Area Command, which is under a general called Joe Stilwell, Vinegar Joe Stilwell. He's a quite invidious position, really, as the leading American general in the theatre. He has to liaise with the British, but he's not under the command of the British. He's an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of the Chinese nationalists. Chiang had actually sent Chinese troops into Burma at the closing stages of the campaign in early 42. You know, they perform well to cover the British retreat. And they end up in northern Burma and they come under Stilwell's command. And these Chinese troops are being given lots of American equipment and, of course, American advice. Their objectives are quite different from those of the British because they're not that interested in actually reconquering Burma. The Americans are never that committed to what seems to them, you know, a project to restore a British imperial possession.
Yeah.
Their objective, again, is to support the Chinese and reopen the Burma Road. So they want to push south as far as they need to reopen that road to China. They're building a new road up from a place called Ledo. So it's the Ledo Road, using American engineers and pouring resources into that in a big way. So they have to protect that work. There are also air bases in northern Burma which are being used to fly supplies over the Himalayas into China, over what the pilots know as the hump. So it's vital to at least stop the Japanese advancing any further northwards to keep those air bases in operation because that is the sole route by which the Chinese nationalists can be supplied. And if you go around even further to the east, kind of the complete other side of the vase from the Arakan, you have the Chinese province of Yunnan, and a front forms there as well between the Japanese and Chinese, and that will become another front in the war in China. And eventually, Chinese forces will cross into Burma and take part in pushing the Japanese out of the country in 1944.
We called it Flying the Hump. Here over Calcutta, India, we got an idea of how much our sky wagons were slated to carry. There was plenty. Tons of food and medicine. Tons of gasoline and bombs. Shiploads of them every day. Even this was only a fraction of what would come. First, while still crated, supplies moved overland by train, due north about 800 miles. This was the slow part of the long journey. Then, near the border of Tibet, our supplies were parceled out to several airfields, like Chabwa, largest of the hump terminals. Here, too, although there was plenty of manpower, the transfer methods were primitive. Until more ordnance equipment arrived, the natives helped fight the war with their bare hands. Some of these bombs weighed half a ton. After a year of operation by the 10th Air Force, we had grown from a squadron of 10 borrowed transports to a fleet of 140 high-altitude C-46s and 47s. By 1943, Hump Commander General Edward Alexander began to set records for troops, supplies, and equipment being lifted over the hump. Stretching before us were 500 miles of rough duty. Before it was over, the treacherous hump had cost us 250 transports, 250 cargoes, and 800 airmen. A high price to pay for the privilege to fly over the highest mountains in the world. We flew continuously, some of the time through Jap fighters and treacherous weather. The clouds made pretty pictures, but at 20,000 feet they could mean ice and death. No emergency landing fields among saw-toothed 5-mile-high peaks for us aerial truck drivers. Flying without fighter cover, it was always good to hear we were on the beam and minutes from landing at Kunming, China.
In December of 1943, the India-China wing carried slightly over 6,000 tons. Before the war's end, ATC had airlifted more than 1 million tons of supplies and 1 million troops over the hump. With the help of Army Airways communications system, flights eventually averaged one plane every minute and a half.
A little while ago, you said that there was very poor intelligence gathering and use of intelligence in the field when Burma was being invaded. How does BP come into the picture and how do they start helping?
Well, it's not a great picture of BP either. In 1942, GCNCS, the government coincided school at Bletchley Park, had been working on Japanese since before the war. There's several sort of different strands of work going on here. You can't see it as a monolith. So the focus before the war was mostly on diplomatic traffic. Our listeners will have heard of the purple cipher broken by the Americans. There's a simpler machine cipher used by Japanese diplomats called Red, which is broken by the British before the war. And so that's dealt with by the Bletchley Park diplomatic section. There's also a different effort in what's called Japanese Military Attaché, or JMA, which has its own section at Bletchley Park by 1942 time. But that's mostly being used by military attachés in Europe. That seems to be the intelligence yield from that. It's mostly about the war in Europe against Germany and Italy.
Stuff that they're then sending back to Japan.
Rather than in Southeast Asia, exactly.
I'm Stephen Freer, and I came to Bletchley first in 1941. I came from Trinity College at Cambridge. I was reading classics. So that was a good grounding for learning the rudiments of several other languages, such as Italian and Japanese. I went one day to the interview, which was in Oxford, and there for the first time I met Commander Denniston. And the summons to the interview had been sent to my home address, and sometimes in wartime the post was rather slow, so I didn't actually receive it at Cambridge until the morning of the day when I was supposed to be there. And I had just time to rush to the station and get the train by the little line which in those days led all the way from Cambridge to Oxford. But I was wearing my most untidy clothes and I hadn't had time to have anything to eat and drink. So I was in quite a bad temper when I got to the interview. And I remember Commander Denniston asked me, amongst other things, whether I was at all air-minded. Well, I wasn't, and I said so. My two brothers were both very interested in aircraft, but it was a thing that had never appealed to me. And apparently, this bluntness was a thing which impressed the interviewers, and they took me on. I went first to the training course in London, and my first day on the course was actually my 21st birthday. After a few weeks, the course was transferred to Bedford, and it was in June 1941 that I moved from Bedford to Bletchley. And I was working in the research section. The head of it then was Jerry Morgan. And we had various problems, but the one that I spent most time on was connected with the Italian naval ciphers. I worked mostly in the house at Bletchley. I spent a very short time in one of the huts, Hut 4, next to the house. But in the spring of 1942, Commander Denniston, who was in charge of the whole outfit at Bletchley, moved to London. He was moved rather like a queen bee taking a new swarm to a new place. And Bletchley was taken over by Commander Travis. In London, I worked under Norman Sainsbury, who was an expert in Oriental languages and later became the keeper of the Oriental manuscripts at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. We worked in an office in Berkeley Street, which before the war had been a hat shop called Peggy Carter. And some of the hats were still stored in the basement and in the attic of the building. And our fire officer was very alarmed because he thought that straw hats were just about the most dangerous thing as a fire risk that there could possibly be. And then there was an offshoot from Berkeley Street where I worked for some time in Aldford House in Park Lane. I was working there for the most part on Japanese diplomatic ciphers. We spent hours and hours copying things out and shuffling things to and fro to try to make them fit. And it was a great moment when we actually made the break and were able to read the messages. I was working at one time on a Japanese code book, which had a limitation. There were four-figure groups, and each group, the first three figures, were either all odd or all even. And this enabled us to work out a pattern so that we could set the messages in depth, which made it possible to break them. And then we could take the differences between the groups and find common differences, which were assumed to be differences between common groups. And so we could reduce all the various columns of our table to the same base, as it were. And then it was possible then, from there on, to start breaking the code book itself. The Japanese commercial attaché in Berlin seems to have invented a little cipher which was really almost a childish thing, and when we were working on it we thought that it was really perhaps not worth the trouble of doing. However, when other business was slack for some reason, we thought we might as well tackle this potty little thing, and did so. And we were told afterwards that the messages had been shown to Winston Churchill himself, because the Japanese attaché gave an estimate of the amount of damage which we had done to German cities in the latter stages of the war, saying what percentage of each had been destroyed. And our people found it very interesting to compare the Japanese report with the reports which our bombers themselves had made.
The other achievement of the British, though, before the war is to break JN-25, which is the Japanese main fleet cipher. So naval code breaking, as we've talked about in the podcast several times before, is really significant. But again, it's not really relevant here to the Burma campaign. It's not really a naval campaign, at least not after the middle of 1942, the Battle of Midway, when the Japanese fleet is pretty much forced back the other side of Singapore. And it's not really able to contest the British in the Indian Ocean in a significant way. So our focus here really is on the Army and Air Force code breaking. And that's an area that really only builds up to a large scale in the second half of the war. Of course, it takes Japan actually joining the war before you can justify committing major resources on it. But also a big development is when Italy surrenders in 1943. A very large number of Italian code breakers are transferred straight over to Japanese work. So they have to relearn their jobs in many ways, deal with an entirely new language, an entirely new system of transmission, or, you know, the fact that Japanese Morse code is completely different from the European version. But most of them do seem to make that shift pretty effectively.
When the Italian war finished in August of 1943, the Italian section was left virtually with nothing to do. And the great majority of us were transferred onto work against the Japanese ciphers. I was surprised but very pleased to be asked whether I would lead the team that was going to work on one of the biggest of the Japanese naval ciphers, which was called JN-25, JN for Japanese Naval. Of course, nobody in the cryptanalysis business needed to understand the full subtleties of Japanese language. What we needed was the language of Japanese naval signals, which was very different. Obviously, once Japan came into the war on Germany's side, there was going to be a need for Japanese linguists. Bletchley Park had a few who were already well into the Japanese language, but that was nothing like enough. The School of Oriental and African Studies in London told Tilghman that it would take 2 years to train up a linguist for his purposes. But Tilghman hadn't got 2 years. But he got advice that it could be done in 6 months. He got Captain Tuck, who was presumably already a buddy of his and had long experience in the Far East, to come and take charge of the course. And he then approached tutors in a number of Oxford and Cambridge colleges who recommended to him young men who might be able to take on this challenge. And they and Captain Tuck came together in Bedford and embarked on the 6 months course. It was a huge success and a tribute to the judgment that it could be done in 6 months. I mentioned, just as one illustration of the success, Marjorie Dale was the only woman on the first of these. Sometime later, her opposite numbers in Washington were so impressed by her skill that they took for granted that she had grown up in Japan. And when they were told that, no, she'd done a 6 months course, they were lost in admiration. The team that we set up to work on the JN-25 cipher was, in the first instance, entirely people who had been in the Italian section, and very much the younger ones. we were not starting entirely from scratch. JN25 was, again, basically a subtractor system. And so it had a good deal in common with the Libya, which we had worked on in the Italian section. And that was a good start. And of course, other people, particularly the Americans in Washington, the outfit called OP20G, and also people in Australia, were way ahead of us in experience. We were never going to be their equal, that for two main reasons. One was simply the number of persons that we had at our disposal. One of the senior Washington US Navy people, Commander Wenger, was in Bletchley Park in July of 1943 at this formative time, and he told Bletchley Park that they had 700 people working on the recovery of JN-25 alone, and that they hoped to raise this to 1,000. Our party started with 20 and stayed at 20 for a year, and the biggest we ever got after we were able to recruit, as people gradually became available from the European war, was 45 was our maximum figure. So clearly we were not in the same game as Washington. Our second limitation was on what we technically called the traffic, that is the enciphered messages as taken down out of the air. The British receiving station at Flowerdown, in spite of the distance halfway around the globe, was able to record a certain amount of Japanese traffic, and that was great, but it was less than 1/5 of the total available. The large quantities of traffic recorded either on the American West Coast or even in the American Pacific Islands came to us in paper form by diplomatic bag about twice a week, but 2 or 3 weeks late. And that was, of course, a huge handicap which we were never able to overcome. At one point, I remember, we said to Washington very politely, would you like to cable us the raw material, and then we could get it hugely sooner, to which, and I'm sure they were entirely justified in this, they said no. So we were stuck with this situation on the supply of raw material.
So there are larger and larger sections in the military section and the air section of Bletchley Park working on these Japanese military ciphers. And it's important to note that the Japanese have the same sort of system as the Americans do, where they have a naval air force and an army air force. So it makes sense from the perspective of code-breaking to amalgamate your army and your army air force code-breaking, because they're using similar systems. And that's what they do at Bletchley Park. Late 1944, they set up a section called JAFO, which is short for Japanese forces, bringing together those military and air section code-breakers in one group. And those are based in Block F, one of the new buildings, one of the largest of those blocks that are built in the second half of the war, right at one corner of the Bletchley Park site. And when they go into their offices, these workers have to walk down a very long corridor past the Newmanry and the Testery working on Lorenz traffic, past the German air section, right to the end of the building. So that corridor inevitably becomes known as the Burma Road.
So presumably, while you were learning Japanese, nobody told you what you were going to do with it.
No, but it was fairly obvious because we only learnt military words. The vocabulary was totally Japanese Air Force. So by, dint of imagination, you could only hope and think that this will be something to do with war in the Far East.
Were you learning the Japanese characters?
Yes. First of all, we learnt kana, 32 characters, to take the place of grammar, because the Japanese language does not have grammar. And so we were given small kana cards with the 32 characters. And we used to go from our RAF unit on the 14 bus with our characters. And people used to look and wonder what on earth we were doing, because we used to fiddle with these cards on the 14 bus. And we used to sit on the top of the bus, all seven of us, and flicking these cards. And people were so curious that they never did ask, what are you doing? But it was quite obvious they wanted to know.
So when that finished, presumably they told you to report to Bletchley Park. Is that what happened next?
No. It was never mentioned. No, I was told to get out
I think it was at the third stop on the train, I was given a railway warning and told to get out at the third stop. Bletchley was never mentioned.
So you arrived, you arrived at the third stop. Were you then taken into Bletchley Park itself at some point?
Oh, yes. Well, you were told where to go and I just reported to Joe Hooper.
And can you remember which building that was in?
That I've tried to remember, but it's been obliterated, of course. It's no longer there, so I can't remember. It was a concrete building, and we used to walk right to the very end, and it was known as the Burma Road.
I think that was probably Block F.
That's right, it was.
Which, of course, was pulled down about 30 years ago.
Oh, yes.
So Joe Hooper, was you met him on the first day?
Yes.
And what did he tell you you were going to be doing?
He took me into an office and there was a squadron leader there whose name was Bill Elson. And the first job I had to do was extremely boring. The call sign index was terribly behind. Nobody had worked on it for a long time. And my first job was to bring the call sign index up to date. And it took quite a long time because it had been neglected.
Can you give us an idea of what these codes sort of look like? I mean, when people think of Enigma, they think of these groups of five letters going out on Morse code. What are these Japanese codes like?
So they're not machine ciphers, right. Important to stress. Japanese generally aren't using machines. They're using your more traditional sort of code book-based system, which generally we call additive codes. So the way these work is you will use a code book to turn your message word by word or phrase by phrase into code groups. These can be groups of letters or groups of numbers. They can be variable lengths. That's just detail. But you encode your message and then you add a cipher on top of the code groups. So you can do that in various ways, but the typical way is that you have a book of additives, as they're called, and you add these to the code groups using non-carrying addition. So if you add 4 and 5, if you have 5 in your code group and 4 in your additive group, you'll get 9, and that will be your encrypted number, which you will transmit. Normally, these are numerical, and the Japanese transmit them using a simple system where each number is represented by a letter, but that's easy to
So basically,
to work out.
You've got, you've had a word or a phrase which has a specific number given to it, and then you're adding a second number from this additive book to give you a new third number, and that's what's transmitted.
Absolutely. So the recipient then, there'll be an indicator group at the start of the message which tells you which part of your additive book has been used to apply the second layer of encryption, and you'll find the right part of your additive book, you'll subtract all the numbers again, revealing the underlying code groups, and then you'll decode them. So it's a slightly cumbersome system, but these are pretty versatile. It means you can issue a code book and keep it in use for a long time, and you can add a new encryption on top of it every day. And it's sort of like making it a whole new code book. But it does have certain weaknesses, and it's quite prone to operator error. And if listeners are familiar with JN25, Naval Cipher works in pretty much the same way, and many of the weaknesses are the same. And with JN25 and these Army Air Force codes, the problem is always that the operators don't select additives from the additive books randomly. They tend to open it to the first page and use the additives on the first line, or use certain parts of the book more than others. So you get lots of messages which are super enciphered using the same additives. So effectively, they're in cryptographic parlance, they're in depth. So your code breaking process is basically to find messages that are in depth in the first instance. If you know something about the enemy traffic and the underlying code book that they're using, and you know some of those numerical code groups, if you subtract the code group from the message, it will leave you with the additive.
Yep.
So if you're trying to work the additive out, that can be quite a useful way of doing it. And if you've got a number of other messages that are in depth, and you subtract a code group from the message at the top to get a little bit of additive, and then you subtract the additive from the other messages, you might find that one of them comes out with another common code group which you know about. And then it indicates your first guess was probably correct, and that additive that you, your sort of putative additive that you've hypothesized is probably correct. Then once you've got a bit of additive, you can start extending that break in various ways using other known code groups. You can take additives that you've worked out, maybe apply them to another message.
Because they're always trying to build books, aren't they?
Yeah, so the important distinction here between this and a sort of machine cipher is with a machine cipher, once you've got the cipher key, you can read all the traffic on that key. With a book-based system like this, you're breaking it code group by code group or additive group by additive group. And it means you can never read the whole system. You can only ever read a proportion of it. And sometimes you can only read quite a small proportion of it. And the more common words you will tend to decrypt pretty quickly, but a word that never appears in a message, you can only deduce its code group from context, if ever. But, you know, a certain proportion of the traffic will always be unreadable. And that makes the intelligence problem here quite a lot trickier in many ways than what you get with the machine ciphers. But, you know, you break these codes in quite a creative way. You know, you exploit what you know about the underlying message traffic. So, for example, if you know a code has groups for punctuation, if you decode the group for open bracket, you know there's going to be a closed bracket somewhere on in the message a certain number of places. If you're experienced with the traffic, you might know what goes in that bracket. And if it's a number, you might know how many digits that number is likely to be. So you can start anticipating what's going on. And with a number group, of course, you've only got 10 possible digits that it might be. So that, you know, reduces the possible options quite substantially. If the enemy are spelling out a word letter by letter, because there will be a certain number of code groups that can represent letters to spell things out that aren't in the code book, you might be able to guess the rest of the word and extract a stretch of additive that way. And then every time you build up a bit of the additive book, you can apply that to different messages that you find that are overlapping with it. And bit by bit, over time, over weeks and months sometimes, you build up a picture of how the code book works and you break more and more of the traffic. So it's a much more iterative process in many ways than breaking the machine ciphers that people are normally familiar with. And it's much more creative and it's much less about pure logical deduction in many ways, although that's an important part of it. So you see these figures in the Japanese code breaking who have this mix of skills, these creative and almost mathematical skills, and especially musicians, which is really interesting. So we know a lot about music at Bletchley Park, of course, as a recreational activity, but there are some leading code breakers who are musicians or composers by trade. We have Daniel Jones, who's a Welsh composer. He's a contemporary of Dylan Thomas. He's in his Cardamar gang hanging out in Swansea before the war with another BP figure, Vernon Watkins, who works in the German air section.
Who writes a poem about them.
Indeed. We also have Herbert Murrell. Herbert Murrell is later head of music at the BBC and has associations with BBC before the war. And I haven't been able to prove it, but my suspicion is the BBC Symphony Orchestra goes to Bedford, which is where, of course, Bletchley Park has its Japanese school and its code-breaking school in the form of the Inter-Service Special Intelligence School. And my suspicion is that Murrell made certain contacts in the BBC who knew people in intelligence, and they got him into code-breaking in Bedford, and he makes his way to Bletchley Park. And you can see why they needed these people, because music's obviously mathematical.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with patterns. And so some of the skills are obviously very transferable, but I think you can see some skills transfer especially well to Japanese codes. So as an example, we have some of Daniel Jones's working material on display in Block C. And not long ago, we had a visit from a Canadian composer working on a project about the bomb machine called Jack Campbell. Right. I showed him this and asked him his opinion on it. I don't read music, so it's all Greek to me. But what Jack told me is that what's on this paper, it has bits of Japanese notation and bits of musical notation. And what the music shows is a scale being transposed at different positions.
Oh, right, yeah.
If you think about what a musician is doing when they transpose a scale, it's not a lot different from taking a line of putative additives that you've got from cribbing a Japanese message and transposing it in different places to see if anything recognisable comes out.
No, it's not. I've just thought of that.
So whether Jones is playing with the music in the same way he plays with the code material that he's working on, whether he's practicing that skill in a very conscious way.
Well, as a musician, I can tell you that transposing, it is kind of second nature. You learn it. So it is a different skill set. Yeah. I don't think you even tend to think beyond the fact, oh, I need to transpose this from, you know, C to F or whatever. You know, it's you just, you know that, all right, if I do that, I now have to do that. So yeah, that does make a lot of sense, actually.
So they've got this sheet of squared paper. They're playing with these code groups, moving them around, transposing them, seeing what comes out. You can see why some of these musicians were very, very good at it.
The famous Hurricane, which turned the scales in the Battle of Britain, has just gone out of production. But this old warrior is still doing fine work on the Burma front. These men are taking off for a special mission, demanding pinpoint precision bombing. Intelligence officers have learned that between 50 and 60 Japanese are hiding in the heart of the jungle. You may be sure that when they are finished with it, There'll be precious little of this particular refuge left to the enemy. These converted Hurricanes, now called Hurry Bombers, carry two 500-pound bombs tucked beneath the wing. Down there, somewhere in that tangled wilderness, lies their target. Or rather, that's where their target lay. After this heavy pounding, there'll not be much hospitality left in it for the Japanese invader. Over these rugged mountains our planes go to carry the battle to the enemy. The attack is taken up by the infantry. The enemy has been forced to run and leave behind a vast array of equipment. Among the booty is a Japanese flag, the rising sun. But the Jap sun is setting as our men force their way along the rain-soaked roads defying the monsoon to hurl back the invader and shatter his dream of conquest in India.
Now, all this Japanese code-breaking isn't just happening in the countryside in Buckinghamshire, is it?
No, so it's also going on in Southeast Asia. And this is another reason why the story hasn't been told in a big way. The picture is very confusing. Working out what work went on where and was done by
who. Because it's so widespread.
Because it was so widespread, it's very difficult to work out. So the British have been intercepting traffic in India since the 1920s. And their first station in India was what is now in Pakistan, actually, Abbottabad in northern Pakistan, almost on the border with Afghanistan. And they've got a centre there called the Wireless Experimental Depot, mostly listening on Soviet traffic in the interwar years, but also Japanese stuff.
I think that's where Tiltman is at one point, isn't he?
Yeah, and you know, it's where he gains important experience in these sorts of codes. Absolutely. In the 1930s, they set up another centre called the Wireless Experimental Centre. This is in Delhi, at a college on a hill called Anand Parbat, which means the Hill of Happiness in the middle of Delhi. And that is the main Bletchley Park outpost for army air code breaking in India right through the campaign. But they've got a few other interception and code breaking centres as well. They're doing interception in Burma, actually, until the Japanese kick them out, feeding information back to WEC in Delhi. And it eventually has two outposts of its own, which are the Western Wireless Subcentre in Bangalore, which is kind of south central India, and the Eastern Wireless Subcentre at Barrackpore near Calcutta, the northeastern India. So the various different Japanese code-breaking tasks are being split up between these different centres. On the army side, that is, the RAF also has its units called wireless units in the theatre, operating in various places, often quite close to the front line. There is a tactical layer to this, in that there are army and RAF tactical Y units accompanying the forces wherever they go in Burma, often seeing the brutality of the fighting firsthand in many cases. So you've got all these different sort of strategic and tactical centres in India and Burma. They're liaising with Bletchley Park, with American and Australian code-breaking centres. That's the reason why it's so difficult to work out now exactly what the system looked like, but it was substantial. We can say that for sure. It's thousands of people spread right across the theatre involved in the signals intelligence work. And a really important aspect of that is actually how diverse it is. It is a rare example of ethnic and racial diversity in signals intelligence in World War II. Generally, intelligence work of any type is the preserve of those of pure British descent in the parlance of the time. But what we see in India is we have personnel being brought in from those various colonial military contingents who are serving in the theatre. The first is probably a Malayan naval contingent who work in naval code breaking in Singapore and later in Colombo in Sri Lanka, where they have their base. But on the Army Air Force side, there are West African signalers involved in this in India. There are Indian Army signalers and also female personnel from what is called the Women's Army Corps India, the WACI. And they're working at Delhi as well.
And David actually covered a lot of background on this in episode 139, The Pacific Turns, especially about the WACI troops.
I went straight to an SLU.
I haven't asked you, how long was your training as an officer?
I think it was only 3 weeks.
3 weeks, right. Did they give you any specific training before you joined the SLU on what that was about?
No. I think the officer cadet training unit didn't even know what an SLU was.
Right.
They were only concerned in turning us out as top grade snobbers, I felt, which I was not. A lot of the girls went straight into office work, etc. But I was lucky. I came straight out and I became an intelligence officer along with a group of men.
Yeah. Were you told this stuff was secret?
Oh, yes.
Was there any formality around that? Anything you had to sign or anything
of
that sort?
We had to sign the Official Secrets Act. But automatically, if you're in the army, you were expected not to talk.
Yes.
Whoever you were.
Yeah.
Signing the Official Secrets Act was just stamping something that was accepted anyway. There was an SLU in New Delhi, there was an SLU in 14th Army, and there was an SLU in SIAC, that Southeast Asia Command, in Sudan.
What was the work that your SLU did?
Well, it was dealing with intercepts, passing them on. We were used as a kind of clearinghouse for intelligence. It was sent to us from Bletchley. We had specially trained, they were men, and they were the RAF who operated the Type X. Whatever information we collected was not our business as to where it was sent. My husband, who was just one of the officers who I married in the end.
Right.
He was a kind of roving intelligence officer. He went off to set up an arrangement for Slim in 14th Army to receive whatever stuff we got that was relevant to him. They went off with one of these machines where everything was coded and what have you.
Yes.
When the focus of the war shifted to Malaya, my bill was sent down to do the same thing for Louis Mountbatten. When we were in Bangalore, the intercepts, a lot of them were coming from Japanese planes, and a lot of them were coming from shipping. When we were in New Delhi, some of the intercepts were coming from diplomatic channels which were being bugged. I know, and I never found out why, but there was a source somewhere in Persia that supplied us with stuff.
Right.
And stuff from somewhere in Afghanistan. But what they were, well, you see, this was the trouble. It's very hard to ask somebody to break their memories when they've had to work in a pocket. You know, we were forced to work in pockets for security's sake. We were told not to gossip between ourselves. Yeah. No good saying to somebody, fancy what I had this morning. You know, what came across my desk. That was discouraged.
These intercepts, so they came into you. Can you remember how they came to you? Did they come to you teleprinter? Was it by dispatch rider? Was it post?
They were the Wireless Experimental Centre, which was outside New Delhi. They received all the messages. They sent it across to us from Korea. Right. We didn't do the intercepting. They did.
They did.
They sent the stuff to us to handle and disseminate.
So these intercepts, you actually could read them, you could see them?
Oh, yes. They were plain type when they came to
you. Plain text when they came to you. Right.
WEC had all the means of reading Japanese codes and what have you. There were departments alongside departments. Most of them didn't know who was doing what. Had to be that way. I know there was somebody who used to send stuff which of the value of which I was unable to understand. This is the one somewhere in Persia who was sending us stuff which we had to send on. It's very hard. You see, at the time you're told to read and forget. And there was such a lot. So unless you were a spy, you read and forgot.
Right.
You know, somebody had quite a lot to say, and others would just say something like reporting air traffic or troop movements or something.
Right. So the messages came to you from the Wireless Experimentation Centre, and you passed them on to...
To Bletchley, really, we were...
Oh, you passed them to Bletchley?
We had two way, but as you see, I didn't operate any of the machines.
No.
I had a go for the fun of it.
Right.
Very hard not to.
Yes.
It's this very interesting machine. But mostly what I did is I sat at a desk. I got all this bump. I organised it, catalogued it, read and forget. So some would come from Bletchley.
You said you were part of GHQ, so General Headquarters. Was that where you were passing them on to?
I'm not quite... Now, you've got to excuse me on this. You've no idea how tight the security was. And this business of discouraging you from talking, you got used to it. the only time it's ever affected me, I found no problem whatever. I didn't want to say fancy. I just was not of that mind. Yeah. And I rather think that that's why those of us who work together, yes, work together,
yeah,
because we had been selected,
yeah,
because we were not of that mind. We knew how to keep a still tongue. Some things that were marked for Viceroy only or for General so-and-so, yes, only,
right,
for that we had a courier. When we were in Delhi, we had a courier. It, right, used to amuse me. He would set off on a bicycle with top secret things in his pocket to go and deliver them to the Americans. Do you know, occasionally I used to feel I was living in cloud cuckoo land.
I've actually interviewed a couple of our veterans at reunions who were both members of what's really known as the Forgotten Army, because they seem to feel that they were forgotten because all of the attention was on Europe, really. They're very proud men, and they had a very distinguished leader, didn't they?
Yes, yeah, so the British forces in Burma are organised in 14th Army from, I think, 1943, and that's the Forgotten Army, and its commander is William Slim, Bill Slim, who is, I think, accepted as one of the leading generals, if not the best British general,
yeah,
of the Second World War.
And probably the most loved by his troops as well, I think.
Absolutely, and you know, it's fundamental to victory in Burma what Slim is able to achieve in terms of morale. But his background is as a regular pre-First World War officer, wounded at Gallipoli, serves in the army right through the interwar years. He teaches at Staff College, he's in the Indian Army. And this is part of why he's the perfect man for the job, is he understands the multinational force which he is leading. He speaks the languages of the men. He understands the different backgrounds and what their needs are. He writes an excellent memoir after the war called Defeat into Victory about the Burma campaign. And it's a fantastic read, and he goes into great length about the issues that he deals with. What comes across there is his warmth as well, and his, you know, his love of soldiering. He loves to be in the front line, seeing what's happening there on the ground, and he understands what his men are going through, and he believes that he can't lead unless he's there. We'll come back to that in a little bit, as this style of command, it kind of feeds into the way he uses intelligence.
Because before we started recording, you were speaking to me about this, and you were saying how passionately he writes about the early part of this campaign, doesn't he? Because he's in the thick of it.
Yeah, the part of the book where Slim is describing the defeat, he comes in as commander of Burma Corps just after the Battle of the Sitang Bend, and he oversees that retreat, and even though the British are losing, it's not the first time he's tasted defeat, but it's the most serious one. He clearly was enjoying every second of it, just doing the soldiering. When he's at a headquarters hundreds of miles behind the front, you can tell that although he understands the value of the job he's doing, and he does it very well, it's not the place he really wants to be.
Every year from May until September, Burma lies under the monsoon. For 4 months, the rain and wind and mist sweep in from the Bay of Bengal, turning the dusts of summer into mud, setting free malaria, dysentery and typhus, enemies more deadly than the Jap. Every stream and riverbed carries a swirling torrent. Man's natural resistance weakens. In this watery world, he forgets what it is to be dry. The body weeps unceasingly with sweat. Mildew grows on boots, and the smell of mold clings to the clothing, while thoughts of distance, isolation, and loneliness rise up to try the spirit.
Let's go back to the actual fighting. Can you give us a bit more background to what the fighting in Burma is like? Because it is a different campaign, isn't it, to what we would see in North Africa and Italy and Western Europe?
Yeah, the first thing that distinguishes it is the brutality and the savagery of the fighting. You know, you have a completely uncompromising opponent in the form of the Japanese, and you have obviously the racial dimension, which means that, you know, the Pacific, I mean, it's pretty widely accepted to be in the worst theatre to serve in. But mercifully, perhaps, you know, the fighting is, what's interesting is it's relatively small scale. If you look at the number of troops involved, the number of divisions in these battles, it's not on the scale of what's going on in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe. It's nowhere close. But what you have is a very high kind of teeth-to-tail ratio. You have a very small number of people doing the fighting, a relatively small number of people doing the fighting. But the amount of effort it takes to keep them supplied and keep them fighting in some of the most inaccessible terrain on Earth is absolutely mind-boggling. So this is really a war of logistics. That is absolutely fundamental. We won and lost on logistics. So if we just look at how the British forces are being supplied, if you look at their supply line just from India, everything's got to make its way to India. All the equipment, at least, has got to make its way to India in the first place. And then the basic Allied supply centre and command centre is Calcutta. And from there, the route to the front went 450 miles by train up the Brahmaputra Valley. Half of that was broad gauge track, and then they had to shift everything onto a different train because it became narrow gauge.
Right.
Then they get to a river crossing point. There's no bridge, so all the wagons from the trains are uncoupled and pushed onto ferries and ferried across the river. Every train is reassembled on the other side of the river and carries on.
What?
And goes on for about another 150 miles. It's going to a place called Dimapur, which is the kind of main supply dump just behind the centre of the British front. There is a chain of supply dumps here, which is 11 miles long and about a mile wide alongside the road there. But if these supplies are destined for the northern part of the front where the Americans are operating, they go 350 miles from the ferry up to Leddo, where the Leddo Road begins. And that's a total of 800 miles from Calcutta by land. Then, once they reach one of these railheads, everything is transferred onto lorries and taken up to the front that way. Up these roads, which have to be built from scratch because there are no roads there before the war, which basically dissolve every time the monsoon hits and have to be constantly maintained. And that's a constant job. In Arakan, when they're fighting there, they don't have any local supply of stone to lay a road. So they build the road out of bricks because they have the right sort of clay in the area.
Right, okay.
So they build a brick kiln about every 20 miles along this road, and they're constantly relaying, they're replacing bricks as they're damaged by the traffic. Mm. You know, and in some cases, especially when the Allies are on the offensive in the middle of 1944 and they're working their way through those mountains back into Burma, they're kind of having to dig out the road in front of them as they advance. And behind them, they're either maintaining that road constantly in this way or they're just letting it collapse behind them and they're relying on air supply. So air supply is the crucial factor here, which allows the Allies to operate in this terrain. But the distances are still vast, so you've got big problems in establishing airfields that are close enough to the front line and keeping those air links protected from the Japanese Air Force as well. And finding transport aircraft, parachutes, all the equipment you need for those operations. At one point when they're fighting in the Arakan, Slim commissions local jute factories to manufacture parachutes for him. He calls them parajutes. They have these very creative ways of exploiting the resources of the local area to solve some of these logistical problems. All this is fundamental because the Allies learn to operate entirely off air supply. And what that does is tactically it nullifies those Japanese tactics that had worked so well in their initial invasion. If the Japanese surround your force, you don't go and try and break out anymore. They create a defensive perimeter. They rely on their supply from the air. They outlast the Japanese because the point is when you're surrounded by the Japanese, it's the Japanese who are out of supply at that point. And they're relying on the British running out of supplies before they do. And because of the Allied air superiority and the air logistics, that doesn't happen.
But the Japanese were confident. During 1943, by a series of fierce thrusts, they sought to exhaust our resources and at the same time to build up a full-scale striking force for the invasion of India. In 1944, the blow came. First, a thrust to Bengal from the Arakan. This failed. But in March, the main attack swept across the Indian borders up to Imphal and Kohima. The direction of this thrust had been anticipated. The 14th Army garrisons had been reinforced and dug in. There was to be no more retreat. By April the 9th, the Kohima-Imphal road had been cut and Kohima besieged. Hemmed into a narrow ring, this small garrison was laid under a murderous barrage from the heights above the town, which blasted every basher, bungalow and tree. The 14th Army land supply routes were cut.
The first time this sort of tactic really proves its worth is in what's called the Battle of the Admin Box in Arakan in February 1944. And this is the first time the British really fight and win a battle against the Japanese, a kind of set-piece battle. Because they advance against the Japanese do what they always do, and they go for an outflanking manoeuvre, cut the lines of supply, and the British retreat into their administrative box where they have their mules and their lorries and hunker down and defend it for about 2 weeks against an all-round attack by the Japanese until they starve and have to abandon their attack. So there's a fantastic quote from Slim's book talking about air supply during this battle. He says, "I was surprised at the range and flexibility of the ground organisation for air supply. All the standard items, rations, ammunition, mail, petrol for tanks, grain for animals and the rest, went largely on a regular schedule. But the emergency and fancy demands made were also met with the promptitude and exactness of the postal order department of a first-class departmental store. Blood plasma, instruments, special drugs for the doctors, spare parts for guns and tanks, boots of unusual size, the daily issue of the Southeast Area Command newspaper, typewriter ribbons, cooking pots to replace those destroyed by shellfire, socks, even spectacles to replace those lost. Nothing was too unusual, too trivial, or too fragile to be found and packed by the supply units or delivered by the airmen." As an example, when Major General Messervy's headquarters, this is the commander of the Admin Box battle, when Messervy's headquarters took refuge in the administrative box, it arrived minus all such domestic items as spare clothing, bedding, razors, soap, toothbrushes and the rest. All these items had been replaced within 48 hours and would have been delivered earlier had not the first drop unfortunately gone to the Japanese.
That is remarkably organised, isn't it?
It is absolutely incredible what they're able to achieve. So it gives them this tactical ability to fight and beat the Japanese and not worry about the lines of supply and let the Japanese infiltrate into the jungle. It lets them do their own infiltrations into the jungle. And the most famous example of that is, of course, the Chindit expeditions behind the enemy lines, which are supplied from the air. And it gives you kind of operational level flexibility as well. So what Slim is able to do at the start of the major battle that unfolds in 1944 is he's able to take one division, 5th Indian Division, fresh from that admin box battle in Arakan and move it over to reinforce Imphal with all its artillery, all its pack animals and all its logistics, etc., in about 11 days.
Right.
And that's an airlift of about 350, 400 miles. So they can make up for any shortages of troops, any situations where they fail to anticipate what the Japanese do. They have that flexibility to account for it and get their troops when they need them. There's also an inland naval element to this. So another thing Slim does improvisationally is to commission his own navy. And he builds river gunboats and supply boats and builds up a little bit of a navy of his own.
So a land commander with his own private navy, basically.
Yeah, to keep his troops supplied as far as possible. So you have this amazing turnaround in logistics, which keeps everything on the road. But the fundamental turnaround, as I mentioned before, is in morale, in terms of training as well. Because the feel of inferiority among the Allied forces after the initial retreat was a real problem. And the Japanese did seem like these supermen who, you know, they hadn't been beaten.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the British troops, well, and the American troops, just seemed to think that the Japanese were invincible and they were these special jungle warriors, weren't they?
Yeah, they can operate in the jungle. They don't rely on these supplies. They can kind of endure conditions which Westerners can't. But what they learn over time, and what Slim is quite careful to ensure that they learn in a controlled way, is that, you know, they are the better, they can be the better of the Japanese in jungle warfare. They're just as able to operate out supply, to launch these mobile columns through the jungle.
And to adapt.
Yeah, and to adapt to those conditions.
Mm.
And in the end, they do it much better than the Japanese. And so there is a complete turnaround in morale, thanks to Slim's leadership. And he does this while the 14th Army, you know, is quite conscious that it's neglected, that people in Europe, in the United States, don't really care what's happening in Burma. And they have this idea of the forgotten army, even while the war is going on. But they still have that turnaround and they still learn to beat the Japanese.
When we were in Burma, we were very fortunate in that the operators had no other unit duties. All fatigues and that sort of thing were done by the drivers and other ancillary workers, even though it was a British unit. So the only actual work we were doing was the shifts, divided into usually three shifts of 8 hours each, and it alternated. We had full night shifts, etc., etc. And after that, when we were in Imphal, although it was in fact the official capital of Manipur, which was an Indian state within the Assam borders, there was literally nothing to do. Everyone settled down actually quite quickly to the routine of the work that was being done. The worst feature was that reception wasn't very good, and there's a tremendous amount of interference, which meant it was quite difficult sometimes, but that did change from time to time. And in particular, there was one incident where a detachment of the operators and the small support staff had been sent out on towards the Japanese positions. And they were very fortunate in the sense that one of the operators picked up a Japanese plain language message. There was a Japanese-speaking member of the I Corps who was immediately called in. He took down the message. The reception was excellent. We were quite near. The detachment was quite near. And immediately that message was sent off back to 4 Corps HQ, who immediately sent it on, as I've since discovered, to various SEAC headquarters, Delhi, and eventually to the War Office. So that was the first of the very useful intercepts. Another one which did happen was that one of our operators picked up a call sign which turned out to be from the 31st Japanese Division, which had disappeared for about 3 months previously. No one knew where it was. It had been thought that it was back in Rangoon. Instead of that, it was in the Assam foothills, not very far from 4 Corps HQ. And that information was immediately sent through the channels and proved to be, as you might well imagine, very, very useful and vitally important indeed. The Isama commanding officer did in fact have a signal from Delhi saying how valuable that had been, but that didn't happen until some time later because no one really knew what happened to all the messages that were being picked up. A lot of the transmissions gave a lot of information because they gave call signs and positions so that it was quite possible to trace the movement of the Japanese units, and that helped keeping track on what was actually happening relatively close at hand.
Now, we know throughout the war, all the different Allied commanders, well, I think for as many commanders as there were as many opinions on the use of intelligence and the importance of intelligence. So what was the sort of intelligence that was being supplied for this campaign? And do we know what Slim's opinion of it was?
The sort of intelligence they're getting, I think it's fair to say, is every bit as valuable as what commanders in Europe are getting.
Right.
And again, it runs the whole gamut from the strategic right down to the tactical. What's interesting when you read Slim's account is that his references to intelligence are fairly scant. He's writing in the 50s, so we wouldn't expect any acknowledgement, of course, of high-grade signals intelligence. But he quite significantly downplays the value of it. And this has led some people to sort of speculate whether he felt well-served or not. So, for example, he says about the Japanese offensive in 1944, he says, "We knew the offensive was coming, for throughout January and February, besides the general reinforcement of the Burma theatre by fresh Japanese formations, there were increasing local indications on 4th Corps front, 4th British Corps. But I had not at my disposal the sources of information of the enemy's intentions that some more fortunate commanders in other theatres were able to invoke. We depended almost entirely on the intelligence gathered by our fighting patrols." So he's got an understanding that this intelligence exists in some places, but he kind of feels, he implies at least, that he feels quite shortchanged by it.
Is there evidence of that? Or,
well, this is quite interesting because what's strange is that these post-war statements, they seem to contradict accounts from wartime that indicate Slim was quite happy with his intelligence service. So another source for us, as always, is Fred Winterbottom in The Ultra Secret. And he goes out to Burma in 1944 to supervise setting up a special liaison unit at Slim's headquarters. Maybe it's quite telling that it happens relatively late in the day.
Mm.
But this is when the campaign in Burma's really at its peak, so it makes sense that they would set up the SLU at that time. And he writes, Winterbottom, "The real triumph had been the information which led up to the final attack by the Japanese at Impal and Kohima. It had become very evident from Ultra that the Japanese supply position was desperate and their attack was being planned in order to capture the 14th Army supply depot so as to keep the Japanese army in business. Ultra had also shown the Japanese Air Force in the area had dwindled so as to be practically useless. So he gives these examples of the value of the intelligence, and he reports that Slim was, you know, kind of effusive in his praise of the system.
If they're giving contradictory statements here between Winterbottom and Slim, do we fall on one side as who to believe, or is it nuanced?
So I think both sources have to be treated with caution, but for kind of different reasons. So Winterbottom generally is not that trustworthy because he's writing from memory and he gets things wrong and he misremembers. So when he talks about all this stuff that Slim knew during the battle, I don't think he's quite remembering it right. What Slim knows is that the Japanese are going to launch this attack, and therefore he has a plan of battle, which is that he'll retreat towards the Indian frontier and fight the battle at Imphal, which is an important supply base and a point where he can bring the Japanese to battle. There's a sort of open plain there, which is good fighting ground, while we're in range of air supply and good airfields. So he'll have the air support he needs, and he can do this kind of battle of the admin box model on a bigger scale. And allow the Japanese to exhaust themselves while he relies on his air supply to beat them. So I think what Winterbottom is recollecting is Slim telling him about his plan, his kind of plan of campaign,
right,
based on the SIGINT, which is kind of top level. The Japanese are going to attack. It doesn't mean the sort of tactical level SIGINT is good enough to tell Slim exactly what their supply situation is, exactly where their planes and their troops are. And an indication of that is when they start this fighting retreat to Imphal, the Japanese actually take the British by surprise. They attack earlier than expected. They put more pressure on the British forces than Slim had anticipated. The British have to use quite a lot more of their reserves than they wanted to get their troops safely back to Imphal. And the main way things diverge from Slim's plan is that the Japanese send a much larger force up to Kohima. So Kohima is on the road between Imphal and the supply bases back in India. And it's a completely different situation geographically because it's on a sort of knife edge ridge. The road kind of snakes up this ridge and then down the other side. It's the best place to stop the Japanese in that part of the front. But the Japanese send a whole division that way instead of just a regiment as Slim expected. So it's a far larger Japanese force. And Slim has to pull together scratch units just to throw some troops into the line to stop the Japanese. And it's a very close run thing at Kohima. So that's the part of the plan that doesn't go well. So clearly, Slim's intelligence, minute by minute on the ground, isn't perfect. There are gaps. But by the way, in Slim's account at this point, there is a really interesting reference to high-grade SIGINT, I think, in Defeat into Victory. Because Slim talks about how when they've made this plan to do this fight and withdrawal, he gives the decision to start that withdrawal to the local commander, Jeffrey Schoons, one of his corps commanders. And what Slim says is, what I should have done was to act on my own judgment and give a definite date early in March, on which the withdrawal would begin, and another some days later on which two divisions should be at their new positions. To put the responsibility on local commanders was neither fair nor wise. I was in a better position to judge when a real offensive was coming, for I had all their information and, in addition, intelligence from other sources. So that does seem a firm reference from Slim himself to receiving kind of high-level strategic SIGINT, which Bletchley Park would class as ultra. But I don't think it was good enough. I don't think it was granular enough at the low levels.
No.
To ensure that Slim knew exactly what was going to happen and ensure that his plan was flawless.
Is this similar in a way to how we were talking last month about Enigma? How while the Germans are settled in their defensive positions, they're obviously using landlines, and so there's not as much intelligence. Once they're moving around and there's more use of wireless, they can get more intelligence. Is there any similarity whatsoever in the amount of material they could be looking at?
I mean, I suppose there must have been a similar effect that as soon as the Japanese are on the march, they must have used their radios more. But I don't have enough evidence
to say that made a difference.
To say that it was directly comparable.
I mean, I suppose we don't even know if it's even as granular as it was with the German messages on Enigma, do we? As in, you know, how detailed were these messages they were reading?
They are very detailed, but I think the sort of intelligence they're yielding from that isn't maybe as applicable to battlefield events so much as slightly higher level operational ones, especially on the Air Force side.
Right.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit. We can only judge from the British side, and there does seem to be these problems where Slim doesn't have all the intelligence he needs, or at least he's reliant on other sources. So he talks about relying on fighting patrols. And by this point in the war, they have built up organisations which head out into the jungle, find the Japanese and report back on their positions. They have one called V-Force set up early in the campaign, and they have another organisation which is set up by 14th Army called Z-Force. And they have a number of kind of irregular and improvised units, quite often raised from the local ethnic populations. Mm. And they've built up a very effective intelligence and kind of raiding organisation. So that fills in a lot of the gaps of tactical intelligence where SIGINT is slightly lacking. I think the fundamental reason why Slim kind of downplays the intelligence he has, it's that it's his personality and the fact that he wants to be on the front line seeing how things actually are. And this is what Alan Stripp argues in his book about codebreaking in the Far East. He says, Slim always valued on-the-spot tactical intelligence highly. Neither SIGINT nor captured documents could ever satisfy his thirst for first-hand local knowledge. And so we talked before about how you can provide the best intelligence in the world and commanders sometimes don't make the most of it. I think with Slim, you can provide the best intelligence in the world and he still wouldn't be satisfied unless he's seen it with his own eyes.
He's SIGINT skeptic.
I wouldn't be that harsh on him. He clearly uses the SIGINT he gets and he uses it well, but he always wants more.
Right. Okay. He's not SIGINT reliant.
Yes. And maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because the commanders in Europe, they tend to get very ultra-reliant in particular.
Very blasé about it, yeah.
If it's not an ultra, it can't be true. And that is a mistake that Slim would never make, and maybe that's why he's a better general.
These are the news highlights of the moment. From Burma, Allied headquarters reports that small parties of Japanese have succeeded in cutting the important Imphal-Koyma Road at several places, some 60 miles north of Imphal. A headquarters statement says the Japs are evidently trying to make a major cut in that road and make it stick, thus blocking the entire British network of land communications between central Burma and India. There are other reports, unofficial, that the Japs have cut the Ukrul Road. Ukrul itself is 32 miles to the northeast of Imphal. Allied planes continue to hammer the Japs over a wide front, and heavy bombers have started large fires at a railway station in Rangoon. We're also told that the Allied troops who landed by glider deep in Burma several weeks ago under command of the late General Wingate had to stop their air operations for a few days to battle Jap troops which had infiltrated to the perimeter of the Allied airstrip. But the enemy has now been cleared out of the sector and air operations are continuing.
We're in the early part of 1944 now, March, April 1944. The Japanese have launched their attack towards Impala and Kohima. So the obvious question is, what happens next, Tom?
There's a large battle. That's what happens next.
Thank you very much. Tune in next week for more information. Let's have some detail.
So it goes according to plan, kind of for Slim, basically. The Japanese converge on Impal, and they're reliant really on capturing supplies. They're reliant on breaking through, capturing British supply dumps. They don't have the logistics to keep this going.
They travel light, don't they?
Yeah. The lower level Japanese commanders know that they don't have the logistics for this operation, but they can't say no to their superiors. And it's a very unrealistic plan. The Japanese are hoping to break into India, that the Indian people will rise up against their British oppressors and join them. They bring the Indian National Army, so this force of traitors work for the Japanese, essentially, who are very ineffective fighters, but they hope will encourage Indian troops fighting for the British to change sides, which doesn't really happen. All Slim knows he has to do is defend Impal, hold off the Japanese, eventually they will starve, and he will win the battle. And that's basically how things go there. The problem is, as I've mentioned, the Japanese sent a far larger force to Kohima than Slim was expecting. And when the battle there starts, there are about 1,500 defenders on the British side against about 20,000 Japanese attackers on this ridge. And it is some of the most brutal and savage fighting of anywhere in the war. You know, there's very small scale fighting for the different hills in the town. And famously, one of the key points in the defence is the British and the Japanese troops on opposite side of the tennis courts by the deputy commissioner's house. It's that close quarters. And the defenders in Kohima are besieged for about 12 days, cut off. And their most serious problem is actually shortage of drinking water. And they discover that there is a spring in the defence zone that they can access, but only by night. And they're down to about a pint of water per man per day during the time they're cut off. But Slim organises reinforcements. Part of those reinforcements come from that division, which is flown up from the Arakan. And a relieving force is able to break through and reinforce the garrison. And from that point on, it's a much closer balance of forces at Kohima. But at that point, the Japanese go to ground and just try and hold on to the ground they've gained.
Right.
So then it's a matter of digging them out of these pits they've dug on the ridges. And parts of the ridge aren't recaptured for about another 6 weeks. So it turns into this awful grinding attritional fight. But fundamentally at Kohima, the Japanese had made a huge mistake because they focused on trying to take the town. If they bypassed Kohima, which they could have done, moved down the road up from the Brahmaputra Valley and moved towards the British supply dumps, there wouldn't have been a lot to stop them. They could have captured supply dumps, captured airfields, caused all sorts of problems for the British. But instead, they just gravitate towards Kohima and surround it because they don't seem to have the level of initiative they need in their command and control to do anything else. So it's a close-run thing, but they do hold on at Kohima. Meanwhile, at Impal, the fighting is every bit as bad, but the British are nowhere near as close to losing. And their perimeter holds, they fly in sufficient reinforcements and supplies to hold on. About 500 tons of supplies a day being flown into Impal.
That's an astonishing amount of
supplies. By the end of the battle, it's about 19,000 tons of supplies in total, about 1 million litres of fuel. Meanwhile, the Japanese, you know, have no logistics. So there is only a matter of time before they run out of energy, which is exactly what happens.
India's Minister of Information says, "We have trapped the enemy in the Imphal area. He must either withdraw or be annihilated." These pictures from the Assam-Burma border take us into the hills of Manipur, where men of the 5th and 7th Indian Divisions are in action. The main fighting has so far occurred along the roads, where the Japanese have sprung out of the jungle in force at several key points and attempted to establish roadblocks to prevent us from concentrating our forces against him. Tanks, artillery and infantry are in process of knocking the enemy before he has time to become established. This is any man's country. Large opposing forces can wander for scores of miles without ever meeting each other. But when they meet, it becomes a massacre. Japanese corpses are strewn thickly where they fell after being caught in a merciless crossfire from infantry and tanks. They have no further interest in Tojo's gamble. For them, it has meant death in a strange jungle 3,000 miles from Tokyo.
So ultimately, Impal and Kohima are successful for the Allies, and it kind of turns the tide in Burma, and we'll cover more of this next year when we get to these anniversaries. But how far does intelligence actually help win the battle?
This is where the intelligence, I think, is the most decisive. Because you had the high-level SIGINT informs Slim's plan of campaign, and that's great, and it works, and that's well understood. I think the untold part of all this story is the Army Air Force code-breaking going on in those various places, because nothing on the British side works without air superiority. And so it is fundamental that they have air superiority by early 1944. And a big part of that is signals intelligence. So one of the codes they're breaking is called Bulbul. I don't know why it's called Bulbul, but I presume it comes from some of the code groups they were seeing in the traffic. But it's a British nickname for this Japanese code, which is a sort of tactical Air Force code. It's used by the Japanese units responsible for ferrying aircraft up to the front line in Burma. So you can use it to count how many aircraft they have, essentially, if you're reading enough of these messages. Tracking order of battle. You can hit those air bases and destroy those planes on the runway. You can identify them when they're operating and shoot them down. It's absolutely vital. And sometimes they are listening to Japanese planes in flight and sending up fighters to shoot them down. So it gives you that tactical responsiveness. There's another code called 6633. That's a Japanese name. And that's a similar code, but uses a higher level than Bulbul. And so they're getting the sort of operational level information about the Japanese Air Force in Burma as well. They're also breaking the code they use for air traffic control and navigation, essentially, called 3636. They're breaking Japanese weather ciphers. So they know what the Japanese know about the weather. They can feed that into their own weather predictions. Mm-hmm. Over a theater like Burma, that's vital for reliable air operations, knowing what the weather is going to be doing. And all of that means that really before the Japanese launch their offensive, the Allies have already got air superiority, but they're able to keep it as well. Whatever the Japanese do, they can't contest control of the air. You need absolutely uncontested control of the air to be carrying out the sort of air supply on the scale that the Allies are achieving. And without that, you know, Impal couldn't have been supplied. The battle might have been won, but not in the way that it was.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast, To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.